All rise. Court is in session. Call now 215-263-1079. Court Radio 107.9 WRNB is on. Brought to you exclusively by the law offices of Silvers, Langsam, and Weitzman, better known as MyPhillyLawyer.com.
Good morning. Good morning, Philadelphia. If it's 7 a.m. and it's 107.9, this must be Court Radio. And I am Dean Weitzman. You know, if you've been sitting on a legal question this week and you'd like it to be answered, or at least give me my best shot at it, you need to call us in the studio this morning at 215-263-1079. 215-263-1079 will get you into the station where we'll be able to answer your question today on some legal topic. How about those Temple Owls? Wow! 9-2. If you could tell me the year they last went to a bowl game, I might be contracted to give you a My Philly Lawyer pack. Yes, yes, that's it. Today's My Philly Lawyer pack question of the day. What was the last year the Temple Owls went to any bowl game, and who was coaching them at that time? All right, I just threw that in. And who was coaching them at that time? If you can give me the answer to those questions, you'll get the My Philly Lawyer pack of the week. So, I'm joined in the studio this morning by my good friend and colleague, the one, the only, honorable Jeffrey Gross. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. What are you, crazy? It's a beautiful Sunday morning, folks. You're going to have mid-50s weather and sunny. The last day for a few days, because I think we're going to be getting some drizzly, windy, fall-like weather piling in on us before Thanksgiving. Oh, by the way, happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I won't be talking to you before then. Enjoy your turkeys. Be safe. Stay in the easy chair. Again, if you're looking to reach us in the studio, 215-263-1079, but the phones are a-lighting up. So, Jeff is here. If Jeff is here, folks, you know it must be Workers' Comp Day. Jeffrey is the renowned Philadelphia expert. Yes, he is, on workers' compensation. Jeff and I work together on probably 50 or 60 cases a year. And while I do the third-party type of litigation, you know, where we sue people who injure our clients, Jeff Comp gets his clients compensated when their injuries occur in the workplace. And he knows all things to know about workers' comp. And he is really, really is one of the top Philadelphia attorneys on workers' comp and has been recognized by many, many different organizations and groups. He's been rated top attorney in workers' comp. He's a super lawyer in workers' comp. And that's why he and I became friends, and we work together on cases. So, of course, when I have workers' comp questions, who better to go to than Jeff Gross? All right. Have I puffed you enough?
Very nice. Thank
okay.
you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. But all true. All very true. So, today, folks, we're going to talk about workers' comp and work-related injuries, the do's, the don'ts, the top five. What do I do? What's the top five things to do when I've been injured on the job? You know, people are scared nowadays, Jeff. They're scared of losing their jobs. We're in a recession. Highest unemployment in God knows how long, over 10%. And, you know, a lot of people, they just, they're afraid to make a workers' comp claim, I think, because they're fearful that they're going to be axed from their job.
And I understand that fear. That's a horrible thing to have to face, the dilemma between taking care of yourself or taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, if you don't take care of yourself and notify your employer and do what's necessary in order to preserve your rights under the Workers' Compensation Act, you will have a major problem. You will not be able to pursue the claim as you should, and that could leave you behind the eight ball. On the other hand, if you do what is necessary of you under the Workers' Compensation Act and pursue the claim, yes, you may have an issue with respect to your employment with that particular employer.
Yep, yep. It's the, you know, I'm damned if I do and I'm damned if I don't. And we want to just make sure people have, to, as Dean always says, know your rights before you give them away. And so we want to make sure that you know what your options are, and then it's going to be up to you to make that decision, what's best for you and your family. So the top five, we're going to talk about these one at a time. But what's the very, 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 very first thing somebody needs to do when they've been injured on the job?
As I've just explained, the first thing you really need to do is notify your employer about your injury. Under the law, you have 120 days from the date of your injury to notify your employer about this injury and its relation to work.
All right, folks, get your listening ears on. 120 days after your injury and something bad happens. What happens then? If you said nothing to nobody for 120 days, what happens?
Assuming you knew about the injury, which usually you do, you have 120 days from that date to notify your employer. If you fail to notify your employer within that time period, you will be barred from bringing a workers' compensation claim, meaning you cannot bring a workers' compensation claim successfully. It will be barred as a matter of law.
See, folks, we talk about statutes of limitation, and oftentimes I talk about a 2-year statute for third-party actions or for actions against others, not your employer. And you have 2 years from the date you were injured to file a lawsuit or settle your claim. And in this instance, it's not 2 years, but under the Workers' Compensation Act, you must notify your employer within 4 months, 120 days, a very brief period. Now, of course, Jeff and I would tell you that you need to notify your employer on day one. Day one. That's the time frame that we would suggest you notify your employer. So once that injury occurs, an immediate notification to your supervisor that you've been injured on the job with some details about your injury, what's hurting you, what's bothering you, how it happened, and how do they need to make that notification?
They really need to go to their supervisor, not just to a coworker, but a supervisor, and notify that person about the injury. And one thing, the longer they wait to do this, I know they have 120 days, like I told you, the longer they wait to notify their supervisor, the less credible they look in a court of law. So if you're before a judge and it's taken you several weeks to notify your supervisor, although you're within the timeline under the act, it still can be a problem because it appears as if you're not credible that you waited so long to notify your supervisor.
So you look funky, folks. You know, you look like a 2-week-old loaf of bread. You're starting to get a little green. Why? Because, you know, people think, hey, if you're really injured on the job, why didn't you tell me 2 weeks ago? And sometimes there may be exceptions to that general rule, but generally speaking, you know, when you know you're injured, say something. We're going to take a call. We're going to take a call because, you know, people have been waiting all week and they're piled on the line already. Remember, folks, if you're looking to get me today in the studio, 215-263-1079. Let's talk to Kia from Germantown.
Hello.
Hi, Kia.
Hi, how are you?
I'm blessed. How about you?
I'm blessed, too. Thank you very much.
What's your question?
Now, my question isn't about workers' comp, but I'm glad I do know that information, so I want to thank you for that.
No problem.
But my question is about, I live in an apartment building, and the building went up supposedly for sheriff's sale in May. The man that claims that he owns the building told me that I could stay here until he decided to see what he was going to do with the building. Now, all of a sudden, I'm getting notices saying the building is up for sheriff's sale December 1st. So I want to know how long do I have to find another place and get myself situated?
A while. And, you know, first of all, just because the building's up for sheriff's sale on December 1st doesn't mean it's going to be sold on December 1st. Oftentimes, the current owner will come in at the last minute, file a bankruptcy, or file some type of document which will impede or delay the sheriff's sale. Happens all the time. So, but if it does get sold on December 1st, then the new landlord or owner has to abide by the terms of your lease. Now,
okay.
Do you have a lease?
I don't have a lease. The owner of the building actually was murdered in February.
Did you ever have a lease?
I had a lease, but when he passed away, I thought it just would not stand up because the person who owned the building, his mother, she just said she didn't want anything to do with the building. She didn't care what happened to it, and she has not went to court. She hasn't filed any paperwork. She hasn't spoken to anyone. It's just like the building is just sitting here.
Okay. Well, even without a lease, you have rights in Pennsylvania as a tenant. You're not a trespasser, and therefore you have rights. And in order to get you from the building, they will need to begin eviction proceedings, and that takes time. The long and the short of it is that you probably, even if somebody says, "Hey, it's time to get out and move on. We're going to do with this building," you probably have at least 90 days.
At least 90 days.
By the time they get up and running, get into court, get in order, post the premises, there's many steps along the way, and so no rush, but something to think about, but probably not before the end of the year.
All right, Kia, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Have a great day, dear.
You too. Thank you.
All right, we're gonna talk to Beverly from North Philly. Hello, Beverly.
Hello.
Hi. Good morning, Beverly.
I have a question I would like to ask you.
I hope I can answer it. Go ahead.
I would like to know what is the statute of limitation when someone borrow money from you? If it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, in order to receive your money, if they are not paying you back your money, in order to get your money or take them to court per se, what is the length of time I have
before I
can do that?
I got your question, but first you got to tell me where you're from.
I'm from North Philadelphia.
No, you're not from North Philly. I'm closer to North Philly than you. Where were you from, Beverly?
I'm from North Philadelphia. I'm from North 9th Street in Philadelphia.
Where were you born?
I was born in Trinidad.
Ah, there you go. Okay. You know, we have listeners in Spanish Town, Jamaica. We may even have listeners in Trinidad. I don't know. The modern wonders of the Internet. Everybody in the world is listening to Court Radio today, Chris. All right. So anyway, Beverly, the answer to your question is 4 years.
Yes.
Four years.
From the date.
Well, now that's an interesting question. What's the date? Well, probably the date of default. If you enter into a contract today, and let's say the terms of the contract are that they're to pay you $25 a week for the next couple of years, and a year from now they stop paying you, bam, a year from now I would say that they're in default, and at that point you have 4 years to exercise your rights to enforce the contract. From the date of default.
Okay.
All right.
But if they never paid you, then I'd go back
to the date you lent the money to them, and that would be the day, and you have 4 years from that day.
4 years.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much.
Oh, have it's my pleasure.
Holiday.
You do the same.
God bless.
All right.
Everyone in the studio.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Beverly. Well, we're just knocking questions out. All right, let's hold off on our next question. And don't forget, folks, if you want to reach us in the studio, if you've got workers' compensation questions, I know every week people call me with one or two of those workers' compensation questions. Well, today we have the renowned expert, Jeff Gross, in the studio. And then you can reach Jeffrey and I at 215-263-1079. So, Jeff, number one, notify your supervisor, your manager, your employer. Notify them, and preferably on day one of your injury, but no more than 120 days, correct?
That is correct, and it can't be stressed enough. That is the most important thing for you to do when you are injured on the job and you're having a problem.
Now, let me ask you, is it required that that notification be written?
No.
Okay.
You can orally notify your supervisor. It would be nice to have it in writing, but that can be a threat to people And when you do put it in writing, although you're protecting yourself, you look like you're out to do something or create harm, which you're probably not doing. But simply a verbal notification suffices. It may be helpful to do that to multiple supervisors. So if you have more than one supervisor, tell everyone. Tell them all. Tell your supervisor. Tell your other supervisor. Tell his supervisor. Tell everyone.
Okay. All right. So we're like David Letterman, and number two on our top five list.
The second thing would be to also notify your coworkers.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Why?
It's not a requirement under the Workers' Comp Act, but to look particularly credible, you should also tell the people that are working with you, as opposed to working above you, about your work-related injury, because if you don't, again, you look less credible. In essence, if you're in court and someone asks the coworker that sits right next to you, did he or she ever complain about his or her work-related injury? The answer is usually going to be, no, I didn't know anything about it. He never told me. So tell everyone, including your coworkers. That would be the second thing to do. Spread the word about the fact that you have an injury as a result of the work environment.
Okay. So you're going to, number one, notify your supervisor. Number two, notify your coworkers. And before we get on to number three, let me ask you a question. Generally, if I'm injured on the job, what am I getting? What am I entitled to if I can't do what I used to be able to do?
Workers' compensation in Pennsylvania provides you with two things. One, wage loss benefits, so that if you're unable to do the job that you were doing because of this injury, you're entitled to wage loss benefits. And the wage loss benefits will come to you generally at the rate of 2/3 of your gross average weekly wage. That means you will get 2/3 of the money that you were earning before taxes. There is no taxes in the workers' compensation world in Pennsylvania. So when I say 2/3, if you're making $1,000 a week, you get $666.66 a week. That's 2/3 of your gross average weekly wage. You don't take 2/3 of what would be paid to you after taxes. It's what would be paid to you before taxes.
So if I'm making $900 a week, and that's my gross wages, what can I expect to receive if I can't do my job?
You can expect to receive $600
per week. Okay. $600 a week if I'm a $900 a week guy.
That's correct. The workers' compensation.
Is there a maximum?
Yes, there is. And each year it changes and goes up by an adjustment. There's no adjustment for people who are already injured and already receiving their benefits, but there's an adjustment for new injuries. And every year it changes and goes up a little bit.
And what's the 2009 maximum, if you know?
I believe it's $845.
Okay. So if 2/3 of your wages is more than $845, you don't get that.
That's correct.
Okay. Is there a minimum?
No, there's no minimum. However, if your wages are below a minimum amount, and it's in the range of $300 and some per week at this point, then you're entitled to 90% of your pre-injury gross average weekly wage.
So if I'm only making $250 a week, you think I'm not going to get 2/3 of that, but I'm going to get 90% of that.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good to know. So they want to give you enough to, you know, to make sure that you can live. If you've lived on $250 a week, they figure you can live on $225 a week, but not 2/3 of that.
Yes, and a lot of that has to do with the taxing implications of things. If you're taxed at that level, your tax rate's going to be different than if it were at a higher rate. So you're getting, by statute, 90% of your pre-injury average weekly wage.
Okay.
You're listening to Court Radio, brought to you by the law offices of Silver, Langsman, and Weitzman, better known as MyPhillyLawyer.com.
Ah, okay. Where did that come from? Well, let's see. I could do a good job of doing that. I mean, listen, everybody knows. We're on speed dial. MyPhillyLawyer, 215-227-2727. All right, we're going to take Linwood. Good morning, Linwood from Yadin.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good, considering the circumstances.
Well, tell us. Tell us. Jeffrey's here. What's your workers' comp question?
Well, I worked for a major corporation in our city here probably 12 years. I got hurt in May of 04. I have C4, 5, and C6 nerve damage. Needles and pins constantly in both of my hands and wrists. I've probably been through, I guess, three different sessions of therapy a year since I've been out. It took me 2 years to win my workman's comp. They kept me on workman's comp for about a year, year and a half, and they taped me one day. They were following me, but they taped me, saw me bending down one day, and I was doing something else for a couple of seconds. I went to court. Eventually, they disconnect cut me off of workman's comp about a year and a half later. Now, at the same time that they disconnected me, I went and applied for Social Security disability and won my Social Security disability with the same evidence that I gave them for workman's comp. So an attorney told me what happened. She never suggested that I appeal or anything. So probably about a year later, I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, well, why shouldn't I appeal this? So we appealed that decision. And now the hearing board agreed with us that the judge didn't, look over all our evidence correctly and what's what. But anyway, the judge has a reputation of taking people off of workers' comp. My question is, can you petition against that judge, have them give you another judge? And also, what are my options of changing attorneys in the middle of something like this?
Okay, so at this current moment, you filed an appeal, and your appeal was granted, and you're going back before the judge who heard your case originally.
I think it's the same judge. Yes.
Okay, all right. So that's where he is. He's successfully appealed, and he's ready to present his case again. What's the story?
Got it. That is called a remand, folks. If you have a decision that's adverse to you, that's against your interests, and you file an appeal, it goes in front of a board called the Workers' Compensation Appeal Board. And that is litigated in front of that board. If you're successful, which it appears, is this Linton?
Linwood.
Linwood. Excuse me, Linwood. According to what Linwood is telling us, he was successful at the appeal board level. So what happens generally is one of two things. The case will get reversed and he will get his benefits, or the case will get remanded, which sounds like what happened to him. And when it gets remanded, it goes back in front of the same judge for findings that are more applicable to his situation. And my guess is, Linwood, that when the judge made his or her original decision, that some of the findings of facts or conclusions of law were incorrect or not adequate, and the board has remanded the case for further findings consistent with the issues on appeal. It goes in front of the same judge because the judge has to be familiar with the evidence of record. So because you established a record in front of this particular judge, then it's going to go in front of that same judge to correct the problem that he or she made.
Except, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jeffrey, but if Linwood could establish through competent evidence that the judge was biased or prejudiced against Linwood's case in particular, then perhaps he could get the judge to recuse himself, folks. There's a word you might not hear every day, R-E-C-U-S-E, recuse, and that's when a judge steps aside and says, I'm not able to be impartial. That's really the only thing a judge is supposed to do. He's supposed to be, he or she is supposed to be impartial, be able to listen to the evidence and make a fair decision. And when they cannot, let's say they're your brother-in-law or something like that, then they have to recuse themselves and give the case off to somebody else. Not every judge who makes a mistake on a case like Linwood's needs to recuse him or herself. And so the answer, Linwood, with regard to can I get rid of the judge is probably not. Probably not.
Okay.
But you had a part B to your question, which typically we don't permit a two-part question, but I'm going to let Jeff take a whack at it. And that is, can I dump my attorney? You can't get rid of the judge, but if you felt like you needed to, can you get rid of your attorney, Jeff?
You can always get rid of your attorney. if he or she isn't doing a good job for you, or you don't think that he's representing your interests adequately, you can certainly get rid of the attorney. But what I would urge you to do is to try to work it out. I would call your attorney and find out or explore the differences that you have with your lawyer and see whether that can be corrected first.
What an ethical guy. But if you cannot work the differences out, I think Jeff's indicating that you have the right to leave your attorney, right?
Of course you have the right to leave your attorney. You're only bound by contract with your lawyer. And under the Workers' Compensation Act, the fee agreement that you signed, if properly done, was a contingent fee agreement, which means that you only owe what your lawyer has been able to get for you. So if you've lost your benefits thus far and your lawyer has been unable to get you benefits since the time they've been cut off and you terminate that attorney, you probably do not owe your attorney anything other than what we call the quantum merit of his or her services, which is the hourly rate that has to be approved by a judge for the services that he or she has given to you.
And that probably would only come if and when Linwood was successful in getting benefits in the future. I don't think he'd be reaching into his pocket today to pay the hourly rates you're talking about.
That is correct. That's why we call that a contingent fee, because it's contingent upon a successful recovery.
Well, let me ask you something. Typically on a third-party case, or the type of case that I work on, like a medical malpractice case, if one attorney has it and loses the file to another attorney, usually the two attorneys will work out some amicable agreement amongst themselves so that it doesn't cost the client anymore.
That's correct. You don't have to worry, Linwood, about reaching into your pocket if you're going to terminate your lawyer, or worrying about what's going to happen in the future. That usually will be worked out between the lawyers.
All right, be careful there, Linwood. I don't want you hurting yourself this morning. So anyway, that's the answer. If you're looking to talk to Jeff, you can always try to reach Jeff by and through My Philly Lawyer at 215-227-2727. Jeff and I, our offices are so close, we can touch each other. 215-227-2727. Linwood, have a great Sunday, and thanks for calling Court Radio.
Thank you.
All right. So, Jeff, where were we? We were up to number three.
Yes. Let's recap, I think, would be a good thing at this point.
Go for it.
First thing you need to do is notify your supervisor if you are injured at work as a result of the injury at work and you cannot continue to work, or you have medical issues arising out of that. Number one, notify your supervisor. Number two, notify and complain to your coworkers. If you don't tell the people that surround you about your problem, you're not going to look very credible when it comes time to pressing your claim. And that brings us to number three. Number three is to secure adequate legal representation. In other words, call your lawyer. Call me. Call Dean. This will enable you to effectively preserve your rights because, let's face it, folks, you don't know what you don't know. And if you don't know the issues that are surrounding you arising out of the Workers' Compensation Act and your employment and your injury, you may not be doing the right thing. So to be safe, always call an attorney to get legal advice after your injury.
Hey, listen, you heard it here. You heard it often. Know your rights before you begin giving them away for nothing. So, doesn't cost anything to talk to Jeff. All you have to do is call us at the office, 215-227-2727, and we will talk to you for no charge. We will let you know what's what, and if you want to pursue your claim, then in that case, you'll only be signing a contingent fee agreement, which Jeff mentioned, which means that you'll only pay us if you've received some financial benefit as a result of that representation. So, as they say in the old country, no harm, no foul. It's really a no-brainer. You want to make sure that you get the right information, and the way to do that is to call us at the office and talk. All right, so we have notify your employer, notify your coworkers, and notify your lawyer.
That's correct.
Now, I want to talk for a moment Well, before we talk for a moment about the workers' comp exclusivity, which we'll get to in a second, we got to talk to Sherry in North Philly. Sherry.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Sherry. Sorry for keeping you on hold, but you have a very cool question, a two-part question here that we may or may not be able to answer, but it deals with child support and workers' comp. What happens when your child's father or child's mother owes support but is on comp? Can you get paid?
That's a good question, and the answer is yes. The child support authorities will make sure that you get paid one way or another. And there's something in the law called a do not distribute order. That means that if your son or daughter's father is on workers' compensation and owes you child support, and an order is in effect that shows that he owes you the support, if you do not get paid, you should go to your lawyer, because your lawyer can contact the district attorney's office and effect a do not distribute order, which means that your baby's father cannot collect a settlement without first having paid off the arrears, meaning the money that is owed to you as a result of the child support lien. Now, the weekly benefits that your baby's father gets is also subject to an attachment or a lien for child support as well. And the same district attorney that would put the do not distribute order against him would also enforce against the insurance company paying those benefits a weekly amount so that your child support is properly taken and given to you. Sherry.
Thank you very much. To answer all my questions, have a blessed day.
All right. Peace with you. Thank you. You know, we get those all the time because I represent a whole lot of people, you know. When you represent a whole lot of people, there's always going to be a few people who owe some child support. And so I get do not distribute orders all the time. And we work with the district attorney's office, and our clients still get paid. You know, I mean, the people think, well, if I owe child support, I'm never going to get any money out of my case. That's not true. That is not true. You will, in 99.9% of the time, still get get money out of the case. But the child support order also gets money as well, and everybody's happy, 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 happy. So, but that was a great question, Sherry, and have a great day. We were talking about exclusivity, and I wanted to make sure we hit this before we go today, and that is, oftentimes you and I, we will work together on a file because there are two components to a case. Let's say, for instance, you're driving along in your employer's car, you're involved in an accident, and somebody rear-ended the car, and you have a case against the person who caused the injuries, but you also may have a workers' comp case.
That's true. You have actually two cases wrapped up into one. But the one thing that people think many times is that they can sue their employer because their employer made the work conditions bad for them and it wasn't fair or negligent or whatever. They want to sue their employer for that negligence. And under the law in Pennsylvania, you cannot sue your employer for negligence. There is an exclusivity remedy that you discussed or you mentioned, and that applies to the exclusive remedy being workers' compensation. You can collect workers' compensation, and it doesn't matter whose fault it was. So, if you caused the accident and you get injured while working, you can collect workers' compensation because the law doesn't recognize fault under the Workers' Compensation Act. But if someone else caused it, you may also have a claim against that third party. And when we say third party, we mean not you, not your employer, a third party. So,
hey, I like the way you explain that.
You like that, huh?
Yeah, I do. So, folks, as a recap for Jeff, we have two cases, one against a third party possibly, and in a case against your employer for the workers' comp benefits or your salary. You cannot collect pain and suffering or any other damages against your employer other than the payment of medical bills and your salary.
Wage loss.
Sorry. However, let's say, for instance, the at-fault party was a coworker who's driving the car, and your coworker causes an accident that injures you. Can you collect from your coworker?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it really depends on whether you were in the course and scope of your employment. If you were in the course and scope of your employment, then your remedy is workers' compensation. You cannot make a claim against your coworker.
And let's be careful about that. You cannot make a claim against your coworker for any damages that he or she may have caused you other than the ones you have against your employer. The coworker is the agent of the employer, and therefore you still can collect from your employer, because you are in the course of your employment, your wage loss and your medical benefits. But can you get from the coworker or your employer pain and suffering or any other of the types of damages you could collect from some stranger? The answer is no, you can't. So whatever exclusion or prevention that applies to your employer equally applies to your coworkers.
That's correct. But if you are not in the course and scope of your employment and you are going somewhere, maybe to a happy hour or somewhere like that, with your coworker following you and then your coworker rear-ends you in a car accident, that has nothing to do with workers' compensation. You are not in the course and scope of your employment. You may make a claim against that coworker.
Hey, well, let me ask you this. What if you were you don't get paid for your lunch hour, and the two of you leave work and you head out to McDonald's to go get some lunch? You have an hour between noon and 1, and you got to be back at the office at 1 o'clock. During that hour, is that comp or is it not?
That really also depends on what you're doing. If this was something like a momentary deviation from your employment and you were in effect on your way to a work-related activity with that co-employer following you, then that may be considered workers' compensation. Momentary deviations count as workers' compensation. So if you are out on a break and you simply need to go to the bathroom or you need to get something to eat real quick, or even if you go down to get a newspaper, you're still considered in the course and scope of your employment. However, if you're not paid for your lunch hour and you're not really doing anything during that hour other than having lunch, and you go out with your coworker and you have an injury, the answer is it's not covered under the Workers' Compensation Act.
What about on your way to work? What if you're carpooling with other employees, and you're heading on the way, but nobody's gotten to the office yet, and you have an accident? Is that in the course and scope?
Another good question. That's called the coming and going rule. There is a rule for all of these things and a name for all of these things. The coming and going rule is not considered part of the course and scope of your employment, and there are always exceptions, remember, to every rule. So in this case, there are exceptions to that as well. And the exceptions are that if you go to a central location, you mentioned carpooling, and your employer provides you with a van, let's say, to take you to work among your other workers as well, then if that van, which includes all of your workers that were picked up at a centralized location that brings you to work, gets into an accident, you're covered under the Workers' Comp Act.
So, like a couple weeks ago, our good brothers and sisters who worked for SEPTOL decided that they needed a little bit more, and they went out on strike. Employers sometimes would hastily put together a carpool program where they would send a van out to a neighborhood, pick up all their workers, and bring them in. In that case, from the moment you get on the van, you're in the course and scope of your employment.
And you're covered.
But if Johnny and Sally decide that it's more economical to carpool together, and those two decide to do that on their own, not as a benefit of their employment, then before they get to work, they're not technically in the course of their employment.
Correct, and they're not covered.
Okay. And therefore, if Sally was texting while driving and ended up in a heap of trouble, then Johnny could probably sue Sally for her negligence.
Correct.
Okay. All right. I learned so much when you're here, Jeffrey. So much. Okay. We have a question from Carolyn from North Philly. Carolyn.
Hi.
Good morning. You bet you thought I'd never get to you.
No.
you have a question regarding car insurance. Shoot.
Yes. I had a truck. I have two cars. I have a truck and I have a car. And I work two full-time jobs and a part-time job. But the truck was vandalized.
Carolyn, you are busy.
And so the insurance people thought, what happened was I had a back window that was, I guess, shattered or had a hole in it, but it wasn't out. It was still there. I had tape on it. And I forgot to tell them the window was shattered or broke or whatever. But in order for them to get in the truck, they kicked that window in. And also the window stickers, the emission, that stickers were scraped off and part of the vandalism. And they wanted proof that the emission stuff was done. And I didn't have it done because I'm at work. I barely drive the truck. And so he wanted a lot of proof. And I just really wanted to find out what my rights was because I don't really have any. I have some pictures with some things on it.
Okay, so let me just understand this. Your insurance agent, in order to issue a policy of insurance.
No, in order to give me money. I mean, for the vandalism.
Cover
the vandalism.
Okay, in order to give you money to cover the vandalism, once proof that certain items that you claim were damaged in the vandalism were actually damaged in the vandalism.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't give them that proof, they're not going to pay for it.
Right. They had the rental car. They said, we're not covering you.
Okay.
We're not going to pay for it.
All right. Well, the answer is that any time we make a claim under our policy, the terms of our policy control the relationship between us and our insurer. And the terms of the policy will be binding against you and in favor of you. And oftentimes, the way this comes up a lot of times is pre-existing damage. For instance, you're involved in a car accident and you're rear-ended and there's some damage to the rear bumper. But underlying that damage, the car previously was in an accident and had similar damage. Well, the new case isn't responsible to pay for the damage of the old case, and they're only responsible to pay for the damage caused by the current claim. So the question is, can somebody determine what was old and what is new? And essentially what your insurer is saying is, well, we don't know you had valid stickers on your car to begin with. We'll pay to replace them if they were valid, but we want proof that in fact they were valid. Now, the answer is if you have to sue your insurer to get new stickers, let's say, for your car, I think that if you walked into court and said my car was vandalized, you took some pictures, showed them that the stickers were peeled off, the judge probably would say, you know what, to the insurer, pay her for new stickers for her car, unless the insurer can prove that they weren't there in the first place. And so I think the onus would be on them. But if they dig their heels in and they say, we're not simply going to pay because we don't know that this was actually damaged in this matter, then you may end up having to sue your employer. So the answer is, the quick and easy answer is, if you have proof, give it to them because that'll probably get them to pay you. If you can't find the proof, you don't have the proof, you'll never get the proof, then you may have to sue your insurer. And then I think the onus is going to be on them to prove otherwise. And more likely than not, you'll win that case. But of course, you're a busy girl. You're going to be taken off from one or two jobs. You're going to have to get into court to do that. So it's all a matter of your time. What's the most economical use of your time? Can you prove by going back to your mechanic or somebody else that you had valid stickers on the car? And can you take photos of them now to show that they're no longer there? If you can do that quickly and easily, I'd say do it. If you can't, for some reason, then you may have to actually bring your insurer to court in small claims court at 34 South 11th Street, and file a little claim against, whoever, let's say it's State Farm, they're usually evil, you file suit against State Farm, and then you get paid if you prove to the judge that you're out these stickers.
That was just minor. They put sand all in my gas tank, so those two little things were minor to me. I wasn't even thinking about those.
Well,
it was big damage done to my truck.
The same applies to all damage, though, whether it's minor or major. If you've got a contract of insurance, they have to pay you. You show them what your damages are by giving them an estimate of repair, and they have to pay your damages. If they don't pay your damages, then it's time to file suit against them, prove your damages in court, and have a judge order them. You know, I had a client, I hope that answered your question, dear.
Yes.
And I'm going to just briefly give a quick story. I have a client whose name shall remain nameless because we have to do that because he hasn't given me permission, but he had a car parked along the side of his house when a tree collapsed on the car. A week before, he had called his insurance company, who also remain nameless because I've given them a confidentiality agreement. But he had an insurance company. He called his agent a week before the accident and said, "Agent, when my policy is up in 2 weeks, please remove this car from the policy." Well, the agent immediately removed the car, and a week later, when the tree fell on the car, this poor guy calls his insurance company to make a claim, and they say, "What car? It's been removed from the policy." He said, but, and they said, "We don't want to hear any of it. Goodbye." And then he came to see my Philly lawyer, and we filed suit against his insurance company. And they said, "We don't have the car on the policy." Anyway, the long and the short of it is the car was worth $5,000. I said to the insurance company, "Folks, you're acting in bad faith. We have all this proof that this fella had insurance at the time of the loss." We ended up getting him not $5,000, but $15,000 for this $5,000 car because insurance companies have an obligation to treat you fairly. And when they deviate from that obligation, when they disregard their duty, then they may be acting in bad faith and you're entitled to additional damages. So provide your proof, Sherry, and make sure that they honor their contract. But if they don't, not only may you be entitled to the cost of your vehicle, but additional costs as well. And if you want to explore them, you can reach us 215-227-2727.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
And I'll talk to y'all next week.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Remember, if you've been injured from an automobile accident, slip and fall, work-related mishap, or medical negligence, call the attorneys at Silvers, Langston & Weitzman, better known as MyPhillyLawyer.com. Don't you give it a second thought. Call for your free personal consultation. And remember, they don't get paid until you get paid. With over 100 years of combined experience, let them aggressively fight for you. Call them on Monday at 215-227-2727. That's 215-227-2727. Or visit their employment website at MyPhillyLawyer.com.
I love that lady, Tiffany Bacon. Yes, the one, the only. Listen, we got Michael from Plymouth Meeting. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How you guys doing?
Oh, couldn't be doing better. Is the sun shining in Plymouth Meeting like it is here?
I guess so. I didn't even look out the window yet.
All right. Well, it's a gorgeous day, and it may be the last in a few. So ask your question and then go out and enjoy this beautiful Sunday. What's up?
All right. I'm a federal employer. And I'm on federal workman's comp, and I was wondering, could you settle, like, the state, like, if you settle for a lump sum with them?
Okay, so sometimes, Jeff, we get our clients weekly pay, and they stay on the weekly pay as long as they're injured. Sometimes the end of that claim culminates in a lump sum payment, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, I mean, and clients can get lots of money, like maybe $100,000 for their injuries all at one time, even on workers' comp, correct?
Yes, that's a lump sum settlement.
Okay. What's it called when you get a lump sum payment?
That's called a settlement, and it's specifically usually referred to as a compromise and release.
Okay, or a CNR, you might hear people call it. Back in the day, there was another name for that. You remember the old name?
The old name was commutation.
Oh, that goes back to when I was a child practicing law before I knew what I was doing. They had commutations. It was a great word. We loved that word.
Yes, they were commuting all of your benefits up into a lump sum at its present value.
All right.
A claim adjuster told me that I couldn't get a lump sum.
A claim adjuster told him he can't get a lump sum on a federal workers' comp claim. Is that true?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, the federal system and the state system are two different animals. I represent state people who are injured in workers' compensation. Well, people who are injured at work and present workers' compensation claims under a state statute, under Pennsylvania law, which is totally different from federal law. So if you're injured while working for the United States government, you're covered under federal workers' compensation, which is a little bit different than the Pennsylvania-based workers' compensation if you're working for any other employer, not the federal government in Pennsylvania.
And make no mistake about it, what Jeff means when he says a little different, he means it isn't very good.
No. Unfortunately, your rights are very, very limited when it comes to federal workers' compensation or injuries arising out of your employment with the federal United States government.
Have you ever heard of a commutation or a CNR on a federal claim?
I have never, ever experienced an individual settling their case with the federal government.
Oh, well, sometimes we give you good news, sometimes we give you real news. And so you heard it here. Doesn't look like you're going to be entitled to a federal settlement on your claim.
All right.
Thank you and have a good day. Nonetheless, he's receiving weekly benefits, and he will continue to receive weekly benefits as long as he's unable to do his job.
That's correct.
Yeah, but whereas in state claims, we can, after you've been paid for a period of time and it doesn't look like you're ever going to be able to go back to doing what you previously did, we can take that claim and we can accelerate it, and we can get all those future benefits that you'd be entitled to and bring them down into a single lump sum. And there's a benefit to that, folks. You end your claim, you can get on with your life, you might be able to re-educate yourself with those funds, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
In fact, I do a lot of these settlements. They're called compromise and releases. Generally, they're applicable when the employee is not getting any better, has reached maximum medical improvement, and simply needs to cash out, so to speak. And they're not for everyone, and they are for some people. They can be very good because they enable the employee to move on with his or her life and collect these benefits in a lump sum fashion, and that can be very beneficial.
You know, I'm going to go home with my Philly lawyer pack this week because, folks, nobody has called to tell me the last year the Temple University, my alma mater, made it into a bowl game with their football team, the Temple Diamond Marching Band. I was in it in a particular year that they went to a bowl game. I know the year. Do you? If you do, and you know the coach who coached them that year, you may be getting this week's My Philly Lawyer Pack. If you don't call, 215-263-1079. What did Dean say? I said 215-263-1079. If you call that number with that information, you're going to get this week's My Philly Lawyer Pack. If you don't, you won't. All right, we got Mark on the phone from West Oak Lane.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself today?
I'm doing wonderful. What's your question?
I had a collection agent call me about a credit card that I just didn't pay off. And it was $500 was the amount of the credit limit. And over time, it got up to about $1,300. And different people from the collection agency were calling me with different amounts. And I just got frustrated and said, I'm only going to pay $500. I typed up the letter stating that I'm refusing to pay what you're offering me. I'm going to pay you $500 in 4 payments. And in good faith, I'm going to send the first payment with my letter. If you accept my payment, if you don't accept my payment, just send back my check in the self-addressed stamp letter. And they accepted the first payment. They accepted the second payment. The third payment they sent me back saying they're not agreeing with my agreement, and instead of $500, they want me to pay $720, and I want to know what are my options.
Well, you know, that's what are my options? Well, your options are that you can pay $720, I suppose. Your other option is you can pay them nothing more. And if they come after you for the balance, you may counterclaim them for your first two payments and ask for that money back. But here's the end result is that it's unfortunately, they're probably not going to come after you, but it's going to sit on your credit record as not paid and not settled and not resolved. And affirmatively, I'm not sure that there's anything you can do to prevent that from happening. If that doesn't bother you, then I would say, you know, you do nothing, they do nothing, and it just sits the way it is. And, you know, you could report to the credit reporting agencies that you've reached an agreement and send them along a brief statement of what the agreement was, and they have to attach that to your credit record, which, you know, may help you in the long run at some point. But if they are not coming after you, I don't think there's anything you can do at this point other than wait for that. And if they do come after you, then at some point you could counterclaim them. They'd say, give us $720, and you could say, I've already paid you $250 under an agreement. Now you've breached that agreement, and you can request your money back. That would be my thinking on this little matter.
Okay, I sent it certified. So I have documentation that I sent it, and they received it. And everything. So should I just pay the $720, including the balance that I already set?
No, I don't think that's what you should do. I think that you should probably at this point do nothing and wait to see what move they take against you. Because I think in the long run, time is on your side.
Okay.
And so I would wait to see what they do. All right?
Thank you very much.
Oh, no problem. Take care, Mark. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Guys, have a good day.
All right, Sharon, give it up.
Hi, how you doing? The question, the answer to your question was 1991?
No.
Hey.
Sorry, Sharon, it's not 1991, but...
I'm a year away. Hey.
All right, have a good day today. And
all right,
thanks
thank you.
For playing with my Philly lawyer.
All right.
All right, folks, if you got the answer, what year did Temple's football team last go to a bowl game and who coached them, please call us. You've got only a few minutes. Now, we're up to number 1, 2, 3, 4.
Number 4 of the top things to do, top 5 things to do after you're involved in a work-related injury.
And you have 30 seconds.
And I have 30 seconds. Get medical treatment.
Yes. Where? How?
Go to your supervisor. Ask your supervisor who or if there are panel doctors that you need to treat with for the work-related injury, number one.
What's a panel doctor?
Panel doctor is a doctor that the employer and its insurance company contracts with for treatment of people, employees, that are involved in work-related injuries.
Do you have to see a panel doctor?
Under the law, if certain things are in place, and those things are complicated, but if certain things are in place, usually you have to see a panel doctor within the first 90 days of your injury.
Okay. So during the first 90 days, you got to see a panel doctor if a panel doctor's information is made available to you by your employer. If they don't, you can see anybody you want.
That's true. One more thing. The panel doctors are only obligatory. You only have to go see your panel doctor if you have signed a statement acknowledging that when you were first employed and then again after you get injured.
Okay. 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 So, after 90 days?
After 90 days, you can go see anybody you want.
So, if you've got a family doctor or somebody who was recommended by somebody who had similar injuries, then you can, and you're not happy with your employer's doctor, then after 90 days, you can dump the employer's doctor and go anywhere your little heart desires.
And even during that time period, even if they're not getting paid under the Workers' Compensation Act, if you have health insurance, and you have a primary care physician that you usually go to for colds or those kinds of things, you should see that doctor as well for the work-related injury, even if it's just for notification and documentation purposes.
Okay, Bianca from Collingdale, Pennsylvania. What's your guess?
Good morning. Before I give you my guess,
Can you tell me, can you answer a question? Were you in undergrad or were you in law school when you went?
I'm a double Temple alum, undergrad and law school. I spent almost 8 years in North Philly.
Were you in undergrad or were you in law school when Temple went to the bowl game?
I was in undergrad when Temple went to the bowl game.
Okay, so it must have been somewhere between 1979 and 1984.
Oh, you got a bio of Dean Weitzman, yes.
Ha ha, but I don't know which year. Is that good enough since someone else called?
No, that is not good enough, Bianca. I am sorry, but I'm going
I figured I'd try.
All right, thank you anyway.
Thank you. Okay.
She was so smart. Bianca from Collingsdale. All right. Well, we're coming to the end of the hour, and we have number five. Quickly.
Accept your situation. Number five, accept your situation. Accept the fact that you've had an injury. Accept the fact that you have to take responsibility for it and do those prior four things that is required of you. If you don't accept your fate, then you won't do what is required of you. So it's very important to take stock in your situation, and preserve your rights.
All right. If you got any further questions, you can reach Jeff and I during the week at 215-227-2727. And Bianca was as close as you can be. The year was 1979. Dean Weitzman was marching in the Temple Diamond Marching Band, and the Owls went to the Garden State Bowl. See you next Sunday for another exciting episode of Court Radio. Now off to East Devin Collins for Philly Speaks. Hold on to those radio dials. He's right after me.